KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this morning's opening hour of Forum, physicist Lee Smolin joins us to discuss what he sees as an ongoing crisis in physics brought on by the dominance over the past couple of decades of string theory. His book is called The Trouble with Physics, The Rise of String Theory, The Fall of Science, and What Comes Next. And he joins us next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. String theory has come to dominate the world of physics. In fact, two of its leading figures, Brian Greene of Columbia and Leonard Susskind of Stanford, have both appeared on forum. In brief, the notion of string theory posits subatomic particles as strings and loops of vibrating energy. Each string may be about a billion times smaller than the protons inside of atoms, and the little tiny energy loops appear to explain where gravity comes from, as well as the interaction of atomic particles. But the question for theoretical physicist and former string theorist Lee Smolin comes down to, is it theory and good science and good physics, or just, well, a hunch? Lee Smolin received his PhD in physics from Harvard and has taught at Yale and Penn State before helping to found the Perimeter Institute in Ottawa. He's the author of The Life of the Cosmos and Three Roads to Quantum Gravity and the recently published The Trouble with Physics, The Rise of String Theory, The Fall of a Science, and What Comes Next. He joins us for this morning's opening hour forum, and welcome. Glad to have you here.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
Well, let's begin with where you begin in your book. You talk about space and time and the search in space and time like a search for the divine or transcendence. As I read your book, I begin to see that you, a former string theorist, 18 papers, in fact, to your credit on string theory, have sort of fallen away from the faith and the belief. And really what I'm beginning here with is, why was this belief so strong? It grabbed you. It's grabbed so many physicists. What is it if it's a theory that can't be proven, if it's mainly emotional more than rational?
In 1984, when there was the string or the first string revolution, there was evidence that there was a theory that was, first of all, a unified theory that unified the four different forces, gravity, which we understand from general relativity, electromagnetism, and the two nuclear forces, in one beautiful package. And there was also evidence at the time that it was unique, that the version, it came in five versions, but that the version that could apply to the real world was unique. And therefore, one could imagine that as it played out, it would answer all the questions that previous theories left unexplained, and it would make predictions by which it could be tested.
That was the appeal then, the idea of bringing it all together and making predictions both. What could be better than that in the physical universe?
That's what we're here for. That's what we get paid for.
That's what you're all about. But no new predictions, you say in your book, and a theory that can't be proven or disproven.
Well, there's a standard idea of what constitutes a viable scientific theory, and it's that the theory can be, we say, falsified. That is, the theory makes predictions which can be tested, and if those tests go awry, go against the theory, then that would cast doubt on the theory. And there were originally great hopes that string theory would be such a theory, and I should say that those hopes were rather quickly put in doubt. By 1986, there was evidence that there would be a vast number of different theories, and there was a problem going forward making predictions. For example, Andrew Strominger, who's now at Harvard, clearly stated that in some papers around then. But most people in the field were confident and optimistic, which is good. It's important to be optimistic if you're going to do this kind of crazy stuff, because the theory seemed otherwise so compelling, and hope that in time a unique version would emerge. What instead has happened is that as time has gone on, especially the last 3 years since 2003, due actually to work of some colleagues down at Stanford, it became clear that the theory really, if it can at all agree with nature, it does so in a way that comes with a vast number of versions, and there was therefore a crisis, and some of us have been worried about that crisis for a long time. I mean, my first book was about that crisis, but then it became a general worry.
It's a general worry for you in your new book, and again, we're talking to Lee Smolin. His new book is called The Trouble with Physics, is that this has been dominant in the academy. There's been a kind of hegemony. In fact, I would even use, I think you use the word groupthink about it. You're very admiring toward many of the string theorists. Many of them are obviously your friends and your colleagues, but you also say that some of them fudge models to explain away, for example, dark energy.
I think fudge is too strong, but an interesting thing, look, when a large community of very bright people commits themselves to something and then it goes in a direction which is not expected, that's interesting. And it's interesting both because of whether it's true or not, and it's also interesting because we're people and scientists are people, and part of my interest in the book comes from a long-standing interest in how science works. And this is a very interesting test case for me. What do you do when there are different communities of people? And one thing, if I may clear, I mean, you characterize me, and I've been characterized as a former string theorist. Let me tell you how I see it. I see it as I'm somebody who wants to solve the problem of quantum gravity, and there are different approaches, and there have always been different approaches. And I have the peculiar scientific personality where I like to work on several things at once and on all the different good approaches. So it's not that I was once a string theorist and now I'm, you know, lost the faith. It's that I have worked on string theory and I have also worked on several of the other approaches.
You're not a heretic, in other words.
I don't see it that way. And
just someone who has taken different approaches, but haven't string theorists themselves taken, in fact, that's part of the problem, so many different approaches.
Well, no, but within string theory, and the thing which is remarkable about the sort of sociology of the field is that there's a big divide in the field. And this divide actually goes all the way back to the 17th century to fights between Newton and his rivals, for example, Leibniz, over what really is space and time. How do we really think about space and time? And what we have going on between the string theorists and other approaches is a continuation of a long-standing century-old philosophical argument about how to think about the nature of space and time. So the other approaches where I have made, in my own work, I think for better or worse, more impact. And so when people try to type people, I do tend to get typed with them, take the view which was characterized by Leibniz and really triumphed with Einstein and general relativity, which is that space and time don't really exist as concrete, independent things. They are aspects of a dynamical, ever-evolving network of relationships which makes up nature. And the other approaches to quantum gravity are developments in that spirit. String theory, so far, for better or worse, and I think it's for worse, is a development of a picture that developed since Newton and goes through quantum mechanics and the formulation of elementary particle theories, in which space is like a fixed absolute background. It's a stage on which actors come and play their parts, and in string theory, those actors are strings which move around in a space which already exists, and for the last 10 years also, string theory has membranes and other objects in it.
And now we've got M theory, right?
Well, I wish, if you know about M theory, please tell me.
it's a mystery to you as a physicist?
It's a mystery. I have spent a lot of time, because this is the central problem in string theory, is to really formulate it coherently and succinctly the way that a good theory should be formulated on some simple principles. And M theory is a conjecture about what that theory might be. And doesn't matter whether I have failed to find that, but many very smart people have tried to find it, and we don't have it.
Go back, though. I mean, you mentioned going back to the 17th century and so forth. There's a stronger indictment in your book, it seems to me. You say that roughly since 1975, and there have been, you know, some major breakthroughs in physics. Well, in 1980, for example, as you point out in your book, standard model of elementary particle physics.
1973, if I may.
Was it 73?
Yes.
I thought it was 80.
Yes.
Well, but we have, you know, all these things in the early 80s, like Stephen Hawking and Alan Guth, inflation and stuff. But you kind of pinpoint the 70s as being a time when things began to stop. And you say it's the strangest and most frustrating period in the history of physics since Kepler and Galileo. And you say that largely, I guess, because of string theory, yeah?
It's too soon to tell if string theory is a symptom or the cause of the problem. I think that's for historians in the future to figure out. But what is the case is that if you look back through the history of physics, and just focus, I mean, physics is a broad and diverse subject, and we're just talking here about the part of it in which us crazy fanatics try to deepen our knowledge about what really are the laws of physics. There's lots of other things going on, properties of materials and so forth, where they're just fine. Okay, we're just talking about this little corner of fundamental physics, but it is the corner, of course, that the public is the most interested in, because this is our job, is to find the truth about nature for the public. So physics has been fast moving for centuries, which means every decade there was some dramatic advance in both experiment and theory, going hand in hand, so that an experiment validated a theory or a theory explained an experiment. This has not happened in fundamental physics since the early 1970s, and it feels, and not just to myself, to many people of my generation who came into physics just after that triumph of the early 70s, as a crisis. And I am far from the only person worried about it. Not everybody would characterize it so strongly. And
well, you've said it, physics has lost its way.
Well, I think so. And my view is that it's lost its way because the bulk of theorists have failed to follow the lesson of Einstein, which, if I may go back to that divide from the 17th century, the lesson of Einstein was that the characterization of space and time, the vision of space and time that Leibniz had that opposed Newton, that space and time are just an evolving dynamic network of relationships, that message has not really gotten through to the bulk of people working on fundamental physics. It has thoroughly gone through to a couple of hundred people around the world who work on the other approaches, the alternatives to string theory, and that's where the progress is being made.
But there's not enough opening. I mean, this is the indictment. There's not enough opening for those who may want to pursue alternative theories. It seems like string theory is a kind of monastic closed. In the academy, for example, it's quite hegemonic.
Yes, although I should make it clear that that's worse in the United States than other places. And one reason, if you say to me, which you might say to me, if string theory is so hegemonic, why are these other areas, these other approaches able to develop at all? And the answer is that they have broad support outside the United States, in the academies of Europe, Canada, Latin America, the Far East, etc. But something strange happened within the academic system in the United States, and that's part of my interest in the book. I didn't start out to write about this, but as I was finishing the early drafts of the book, it became clear to me that I had to address this, even if I'm not a professional sociologist, which is how it could be that in a field, let me characterize it this way. In science, there are two kinds of things. There are hypotheses that we have consensus about, that there's been convincing evidence that we have to accept that that hypothesis is true. General relativity is right, Newtonian gravity is wrong. Then there are things that are unproven hypotheses. They're still undergoing development tests and so forth. And in the second part, we have always disagreement controversy, because disagreement controversy drive the exploration of diverse possibilities and energize people to move forward. So there's a process by which in the scientific community we go from controversy to consensus. Okay. And normally that requires convincing evidence that blows the skeptics over and shuts them up.
Normally it requires testing.
And
say,
that requires...
String theory hasn't been tested.
And that requires,
knows how to test
yes,
it.
And yeah. That requires experimental evidence. It's a problem for the development of science when you have the formation of premature consensus.
John Schwartz of Caltech, a colleague of yours and well-known physicist.
Lovely person, by the way.
I'm curious to know what you have to say about what he says. He says physicists disagreed about atoms until the 1950s, and so he raises the question, how much energy would an experiment have to pound into a collision between particles to reveal strings? It's a central kind of question, I guess, isn't it?
Here is a story about why diversity of approaches is important. we have all been saying things like that, as everybody in my generation, John's generation is a bit older, in order to make an accelerator that could get enough energy to test quantum theories of gravity, distinguish string theory from the alternatives, etc., we would need a huge accelerator as big as the galaxy. Okay. So, therefore, we have an excuse. We don't have to make predictions and confront experiments. Now, in Napoli, there was a young Italian physicist, Giovanni Emiliano Camelia, and in the late 90s, he got tired of hearing that from his teachers, and he said, that's got to be wrong. There's got to be a way to do experiments that probe the Planck scale and could distinguish these different theories, string theory, loop quantum gravity, etc., from each other. And he realized that we have access to an experiment far larger than a galaxy, which is the whole universe. Cosmic ray detectors detect particles coming from much larger distances. Satellites in orbit that detect gamma ray bursts detect photons that have been traveling through space for 10 billion years. And during that time, Giovanni realized, tiny, tiny effects where the light or the particles are interacting with the quantum structure of space, even if they're tiny effects, they would get amplified in a way that alters what we see when they arrive on Earth in a way that's measurable now. So, in fact, while there is this crisis of lack of predictivity in string theory, in other approaches to quantum gravity, like doubly special relativity, which is a hypothesis that Giovanni went on to invent, there is healthy science going on because, as in fact always happens in science, when there's a good idea on the table, somebody clever comes from left field and invents a new way to make an experiment. And that's happening now.
And that's what you really invite and what really excites you about physics and what has become difficult in the United States because of the domination of string theory.
Right. If my view is that if departments in the United States were looking around for who's the best overall physicist, Giovanni would have dozens of offers to move here from Rome because he's changed the field.
I wonder how something like this becomes dominant. It reminds me in literature of how deconstruction for a while was reigning supreme in particularly Eastern University literature departments because it gets a kind of currency and capital that makes it almost seem like a cabal or something along those lines. I mean, that's certainly what I read in your book.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and again, I want to emphasize this is when I began to worry about this. I mean, look, many people talk within the field talk about sociology. You have a conversation with somebody, they say, yes, it's true, there should be more diversity in American science. Or yes, it's true, at conferences on string theory, we should invite people who have made progress in the other directions to educate ourselves about what the different approaches are.
A lot of that lip service?
And then, it's genuine. And then they say, but there's sociology. And after a while, thinking about this, I thought, look, first, I didn't want to write about this at all because, you know, I'm a scientist. I'd much rather write about science, which I know. But when I realized that, I mean, the people who were reading the early versions of the book said to me, it doesn't make any sense, the story you're telling. Okay. And how, you know, how could the same question you asked, how could this develop? So I thought, okay, I'll make a try at confronting this and see how it goes. So I started to look up sociology of science, sociology of organizations. I discovered that these things are not complicated. There's a profession of people who study these things. And when I spoke with and corresponded with sociologists of organizations or sociologists of science, of which there is a healthy number, they said, oh, yeah, that's a well-known phenomenon. They gave me many other examples. It's a phenomenon when a group of very smart, highly motivated people spend too much time talking to each other and develop a circle of talk where, I almost got into postmodernity and said discourse, develop a circle of conversation where they only converse with each other and they're not interested in what people who don't agree with them have to say. And this
becomes incestuous, really.
Well, yes, and this is, it's interesting because it can happen to people who individually would and do, in fact, worry about that phenomenon when you discuss with them. And it's been studied thoroughly because American corporations, like the car corporations, got into trouble and are in perilous shape financially because their designers were in such a context. The American intelligence agencies studied this problem after the Bay of Pigs fiasco. They studied it again after nobody predicted the collapse of the Soviet Union. How is it that all these smart people with all the data missed things that were obvious to some others?
You talk about the sociology of those in the Pentagon who are planning the war that's going on in Iraq, but we won't necessarily have to go there. We're talking again with Lee Smolin, who's the author of The Trouble with Physics. And your central premise here, to a great degree, is there's nothing new that's taken place. I mean, string theory may prove to be all correct and may prove to be right in time, if it's proven at all. Even the string theorists say, you know, it hasn't been proven. In accord with what you're saying, but there's nothing new for your generation of physics, you say, in extending our knowledge about the laws of nature. No real leap forward since about 75. Nothing that's produced that will outlive your generation.
If I were 30 years older or 20 years older, I would have had the opportunity. I might not have lived up to it or taken it, but I would have had the opportunity to be part of greatly advancing our understanding of elementary particle physics. I happened to begin studying exactly when the Standard Model was produced. This is the Standard Model of particle physics, which is the current, still the current best theory that we have. And it's frustrating. I mean, you know, I remember talking with Feynman when I was a graduate student, and he said what really pissed him off is it was beginning to occur to him that he would not live long enough to see the answers to the questions that he most cared about. But he had gotten to contribute to a vast increase of knowledge. And so, I mean, when we go into science, look, this is hard work. A lot of it is fun and exciting. A lot of it is just hard, challenging work to get it right, to get it good enough to show your colleagues. And the reward that, because we're ambitious people, that we expect is that if we guess right, we may guess wrong, but if we guess right, okay, we get to be part of expanding knowledge. But then there's a second reward, which is at least if we don't guess right, somebody we know, somebody we went to school with, gets to guess right, and we get at least to share the pleasure of that and watch that happen and confirm it. If you go 30 years and nobody you know has guessed right, that is, there may be, because of what I talked about, the work of Giovanni Emiliano Camelia, now of a growing body of people who work in that area of experiments on quantum gravity, it may be that in the next 10 years I'll have the pleasure of seeing something that I did or a friend of mine did confirmed. But 30 years is a long time to go with that.
Coming up on a break, but you think there's been too much emphasis on trying to find unified field theory. Has that been behind some of the problems that you address?
I think that there has been too much consensus about how to go about finding unified field theory.
Again, Lee Smolin with us. His book, The Trouble with Physics, The Rise of String Theory, The Fall of a Science, and What Comes Next. He'll be at Bookshop West Portal in San Francisco tonight at 7 p.m., and you can join us and are invited to do so. We welcome your calls. The phone line's available to you now, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Feel free to join us, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. Again, our toll-free number for your calls, 866-733-6786, or email us. And our email address here is forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with author Lee Smolin about his new book. It's called The Trouble with Physics, The Rise of String Theory, The Fall of a Science, and What Comes Next. We'll be talking in the next hour with Michael Lewis, who has a book out called The Blind Side, Evolution of a Game, From Physics to Football, in one Forum program. Lee Smolin is founder of the Perimeter Institute. And by the way, they're in Waterloo, Ontario. And we're going to go right to your phone calls here. In fact, let's begin, Lorenz, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, Lee. It's Lorenz Gunnarsson.
Hi, Lorenz. This is somebody I know.
I'm delighted to have this opportunity to hear your voice again. It's been a while. I guess I just wanted to ask principally two things. One, What accounts for the extraordinary mathematical fecundity of the ideas of string theory? They've certainly had an amazing currency and impact in the world of mathematics, and it's interesting to wonder why, really. I wonder if you have an answer to that. And the second thing I'm curious about is, what would Imre Lakatos say about all this, the topic of your book?
A little inside there. We'll have to find out who he is. But I'm intrigued by the notion of the mathematical question here, because it is such an underlying foundation and has contributed a great deal. Yeah.
But first, I want to say I'm not the founder of the Perimeter Institute. I happen to have been very fortunate to be one of the first people hired there. Mike Lazaridis and Howard Burton are the founders. String theory has led to great developments in mathematics, and that's very impressive, and it's one of the reasons why people love working on it. But two buts. One of them is that those developments in mathematics have still not enabled us to bring string theory to the point where it can either be cogently formulated in a simple set of principles or produce falsifiable experimental predictions. It may do so in the future, although many of us have tried. The second thing is that string theory is not the only approach to furthering fundamental physics, quantum gravity, that has led to and taken part in developments in pure mathematics. For example, spin foam models are deeply tied to developments in three- and four-dimensional topology known as topological field theories. And the key people who have contributed to the formulation of these models of quantum gravity, which are in this Leibnizian tradition I talked about, for example, Lewis Crane and John Baez, are people who also are very important contributors to the mathematics in that domain.
And he asked about someone specific. He mentioned a name here.
Irma Lakatos is a philosopher of science, was, I think he's dead now, a philosopher of science. And, Lawrence, I'm afraid that I'm going to pass there. I know what Paul Feyerabend would have said, but I'm not going to embarrass myself by guessing.
Now let me thank Lorenz, and I'm going to go to some more callers here. But you mentioned Leibniz a couple of times, and there was how much philosophy do you think is attached to string theory? Again, getting back to that notion of wanting to see a clear worldview or clear view of the cosmos, or one that makes sense and has a kind of symmetry to it, fearful though it may be. I'm thinking of Leibniz, because Leibniz was really an optimist in so many ways. You know, because,
sure.
Yeah. And string theory seems to me to be optimistic, doesn't it?
Well, as I said, all the people who work on these developments are optimistic. You have to be optimistic to get involved in this kind of stuff. When you say how much philosophy is involved, well, there is a dialogue between people who are in philosophy and people who work on quantum gravity, but I have to say that most of that dialogue goes to the side of the field which is not string theory. And the reason for that is that we have understood, and we have understood because of the work of some people who bridge philosophy and physics, for example, very importantly, Julian Barber and John Stachel, who discovered the connections between the structure and interpretation of Einstein's theory of general relativity and the tradition of thought about space and time that goes back through philosophy, through Einstein, Mach, and back to Leibniz. And because of that, some of us were mentored, and it really was a kind of mentorship. I mean, Julian Barber is a sage who lives out in the countryside outside of Oxford, and one goes up and sees Julian and is mentored in the philosophical tradition of what one is trying to do to improve our knowledge, further our knowledge about space and time. And I think that it's unfortunate that the atmosphere, and this goes to a kind of differing styles of research. The style of research that string theory grew out of is a very pragmatic style that goes back to quantum field theory, goes back to, of course, Richard Feynman, who in some sense is the progenitor of that style. And it's a very anti-philosophical, very pragmatic style. Sort of shut up and calculate, work the technicalities of the mathematics. And the other approaches to quantum gravity are descended, and one can trace this through individuals and mentorship to a much more philosophical, foundational style of physics that goes back to Einstein.
It's also the central role, as you write about in your book, of cosmology now as taking a kind of paramount place in all of this.
Well, thank God something has been happening in science, and one of the things that's been the most important thing that's been happening on the observational experimental side of fundamental physics in this period has been the dramatic increase in our knowledge about cosmology, detailed measurements of the history of the universe going back to very early times. There's been dramatic progress. It's the golden age as far as observational cosmology is concerned. The problem is for us theorists, it's the mud age. I mean, those theorists who just model what the cosmologists see, that's fine. But for those theorists who want to understand deeply what is the dark energy, what is the dark matter, where does the distribution of galaxies that those people are seeing, where does that come from, we are stuck.
Talking to theoretical physicist Lee Smolin, and we'll go to more of your calls here. By the way, I can't remember who it was. Maybe one of my listeners does it. Somebody said, if you're not a theoretical physicist and you understand theoretical physics, you're either mad or a liar, which is kind of a strange statement, but nonetheless one that sort of is amusing in its way. Let me get some more callers on here. Peter from Albany, good morning.
Hi, great program. Sorry, I'm calling with a comment, and I couldn't come up with a question, but I'm an astrophysicist, and I'm really happy that your guest is pointing out these sociological problems with string theory. And I think it needs to be pointed out. And an analogy to my mind comes to early astronomy, how after Ptolemy things just sort of stagnated for lack of observations, and then you had a period of scholasticism. To some of us, string theory kind of looks like that. And I think, of course, string theorists would take exception to that. But there are lots of really important questions out there besides string theory that really need to be answered. Things that many physicists kind of look down their noses at is engineering, but problems like turbulence and so forth, and plasma confinement, and these kind of get play second fiddle, and I think our physics department suffer as a result of that.
If I may comment, I thank you for the kind comments, but I think it's too soon to get upset about dark ages and things like that. And also, I'm not a scholar of the history of astronomy, but my understanding is that the history of the developments of astronomy did not stagnate after Ptolemy. They just developed in the Islamic world because Europe went through a period of disinterest and lack of support of science. But meanwhile, the Islamic world heavily supported science. There were great centers of astronomy in the Islamic world. And what they gave back to Europe when the Europe, you know, during and after the Renaissance is developed significantly from what they took from Ptolemy. And that's, I'm told, is a story which has not been told well enough yet.
Let me thank Peter. Peter, I want to come in here with an email because it dovetails from one of our listeners named Andrew, who says, could you please ask the guest for his comparison between the current need for extra dimensions in string theory to the idea of epicycles of Ptolemaic astronomy? Seems like an apt comparison to a mathematical crutch where we simply don't get the full picture yet.
The need for extra dimensions is both an opportunity in string theory and the source of the crisis. And
yeah, where's the evidence for the extra dimensions?
There's so far no experimental evidence, but the problem, and the idea of extra dimensions is an old idea. A number of us who knew something about the history of physics, who found parts of string theory compelling, had this sort of groan, oh no, not again, when it became clear that the extra dimensions were a compulsory part of the package. Because the idea had been tried of unification through extra dimensions, had been tried and failed several times since 1914, and it always runs up against the same issues, which is that to make them unobservable, you have to do something special to the extra dimensions. You have to, for example, curl them up very, very small. And then there are two problems. One of them is there become a vast number of different ways of doing so, and that's the reason why there's a vast number of string theories and therefore a crisis about predictability. And the other problem with Einstein understood clearly already by 1923, I was very surprised to discover this as I was doing the research for the book, is because he was initially very excited about ideas of extra dimensions of people in the early 20s, and then he realized that either it's a unification or it's not. If it is a unification, then the extra dimensions are dynamical, just like the three dimensions we see. They can expand and contract, they can oscillate, and if the properties of the elementary particles and forces depend on the geometry of the extra dimensions, they don't stay fixed, but we don't observe them to vary. Also, they could easily get big, and then we would have to observe them, or they could collapse to black holes, but we don't observe that either.
Peter, sorry.
Yes.
You had something else you wanted to say.
Oh, well, I didn't mean to say that the Dark Ages are upon us, but I think that was a little bit of an extreme take on what I was saying. It's simply it's important to be tied to observations, and I think that we would all agree that that's important for physics and any other science. That's all.
Indeed, thank you. I appreciate your call. We'll get more of your calls on here.
Thank you, and let me say a word for Ptolemaic physics. Ptolemaic physics did make detailed predictions of the motions of the planets and the sun and the moon as they were seen in the sky, which were good to 1 part in 1,000 accuracy over a time scale of 1,000 years. So that's not actually a good analogy.
On we go. Michael, morning. You're on forum.
Yes. My question was this. Earlier the author, and I'm going to characterize to be brief, basically said even really bright people are susceptible to groupthink. And an observation and then a question is, I've worked with a lot of what I call analytically gifted people, you know, people in, two of my friends are research particle physics, the physicists and things like that. And you can be analytically gifted in this way, but that doesn't mean that you're philosophically enlightened or that you don't have selfish tendencies. You know, gee, I spent 10 years on this theory, it's got to be right. And so now the question is, how do you propose, or maybe you don't, maybe you'll leave this for somebody else, to say, well, look, we got to stop doing this. You know, we can't be kind of grinding away at this and participating in this kind of groupthink mentality. What would you propose as methods to try to help the theoretical physics community guard against this? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. We thank you for the call, Michael. Lee Smolin.
This is an easy one, and I took this question to people who studied the question, and in business, in government, in intelligence, I mean, which are not perfect contexts by any means, but it's understood how to fight against this kind of thing happening. If you have 5 different approaches to a problem, and you have in your, let's say you're an investment bank, and there's 5 different strategies about investing on the forefront of biotech, you don't have, you know, and you have 10 fund managers, you don't have all of your fund managers do A. You have 2 fund managers do A, a couple of them do B, some of them do C, maybe one does D, and so forth, because they know that overall the rate of return is fastest if you hedge the investments and diversify when you're faced with tremendous opportunity but tremendous risk. This is an old story for people outside of the academy. And I do make some very concrete suggestions. And there are suggestions that departments, governments, private foundations, philanthropists could easily contribute to. And indeed, there are some examples where some already do and have been doing so. There's a kind of misunderstanding within because of the structure of the academic world and the nature of the decisions that we make, which are very long-term decisions for better or worse because of, for example, we hire people for lifetime appointments. And because of that, there's a lack of sophistication and a misunderstanding about how to confront and deal with risk. Risk means you take tremendous opportunity. String theory is a tremendous opportunity, but a tremendous risk. Go for it. Definitely, it should be pursued. Okay, but don't put your whole investment in that.
Diversify
sector.
Your portfolio.
Diversify
as the financial
your portfolio.
Advisors
yes.
say. And we're talking to Lee Smolin of the Perimeter Institute, and let's take more of your calls. We'll go to Palo Alto next. Alex, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Hi. I wanted to clarify a bit the Lakatos sort of thing that came up earlier. I, you know, sort of Irmi and Lakatos had this concept of falsifiability as being sort of a central feature of real science. So, you know, if you had a theory and you could prove that it was false, then you knew that sort of it actually was scientific. So I think that that was the sort of the, this is sort of course, one of the questions that gets sort of posed about string theory is sort of, you know, is this stuff so complex that sort of you just can't really sort of test it any longer? The other thing is that sort of the comparison to, you know, Ptolemy and epicycles in a way sort of doesn't give sort of Ptolemaic astronomy enough credit because, you know, sort of even though they were working from a much less accurate set of observations and so forth, the stuff actually did work pretty well. And sort of people were able to do a lot of stuff with it for, you know, sort of over 1,000 years. And so, you know, philosophically it made perfect sense given sort of Aristotelian ideas about the nature of the cosmos and the perfection of the of sort of the heavens compared to the sort of imperfect nature of the Earth. And so sort of, I mean, while it's an easy comparison to make, it's sort of almost insulting to Ptolemy.
Thank you. I tried to make that point briefly. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the notion of falsifiability came from Popper. And Lakatos,
Karl Popper,
and Lakatos actually criticized it, and this is why I didn't want to go there. But now that it's been mentioned twice, certainly the notion of falsifiability as a characterization of science has been criticized since then, and Lakatos was in the forefront of this. For example, if you have a theory that says that all swans are white, and you're sitting on the bank of a river, and a red swan goes by, you don't think that that theory is wrong, you go looking for who has the can of paint. And so you have to be sophisticated about applying these characterizations. And there's been a lot of discussion, debate among contemporary philosophers and historians of science, which go beyond and are more subtle and sophisticated than Popper. And sometimes, I mean, for example, my friend Lenny Susskind will, you know, bring this up and call people like me who bring up Popper, paparazzi. But the one thing that's for sure, and, you know, and I've discussed this with experts in philosophy of science, is that nowhere in the literature of philosophy of science, even if it's understood that falsifiability needs some subtleness to be applied, nowhere is it contemplated that a theory could be accepted by consensus among a community without making a single up or down prediction by which it could be tested.
Let me thank Alex for his call. You also feel that it's unfortunate that so many have embraced the anthropic principle?
I do think it's unfortunate. And the anthropic principle, for listeners who it's just a very good educated audience, but just in case people don't know about it, is the move that, well, if you have a vast number of theories, maybe there are also a vast number of universes, and the universes choose randomly through some process, for example, eternal inflation is developed by Andre Linde, which they choose randomly the laws. And then we happen to live in one of those small number of universes where the laws are hospitable to us, and we can only make such deductions as can be drawn from that. And that move to say that is good enough for physics, which some very, you know, justly admired people like Leonard Susskind or Steve Weinberg have been making, using the anthropic principle, is, I think, unacceptable. I can go on and say, I mean, for me, this is kind of old news because, as I said earlier, the idea that string theory might come in a vast number of different versions was already understood by some people in the late 1980s. And I was somebody who worried about that. And really my first book, Life of the Cosmos, was an attempt to understand if you could still make falsifiable predictions, even if there was what I called then a landscape of different theories, which was terminology that was borrowed from theoretical biology, sort of fitness landscapes and so forth in population genetics. And I tried to see if analogies to biology might be helpful in doing science in this situation.
And you concluded?
I concluded, yes. Huh. Yes. But that's many years ago, and that was my first book. And it's been very frustrating to see that the community of string theorists, while originally saying, no, you're wrong, there'll be a way to have a unique theory, has since 2003 come around and embraced the idea of the landscape, but then made the move of going through not everybody, and I'm not characterizing nearly everybody, but the prominently mentioning, and some prominent people have prominently pushed the anthropic principle as the right move to make here, when it was already clear in the early 90s that it was the wrong move because it would not lead to any testable predictions.
Let me give you a couple of, I think, maybe what we could characterize as thoughtful criticisms from listeners via email. Greg writes, I remember hearing Feynman say, maybe in the Messenger lectures, that physics would either be wrapped up in the near future or else it would simply become operationally impossible to detect the deviations of the current theory from reality. Despite Smolin's reference to cosmic ray tests, isn't that an inevitability that Smolin ignores, that as fundamental physics probes into regimes farther and farther removed from human accessibility, first laboratory physics is outstripped, and then observational cosmology becomes useless? Perhaps we're not quite there yet, but isn't this inevitable? And Brian says, I appreciate Professor Smolin's nuanced rendition of what's happening in physics, but it's worth emphasizing this is not Watergate or Enron. This is possibly a case of what happens when well-intentioned people wander off track. For example, the tendency of the string theory community only to talk to each other originates simply in a desire for efficiency. If all you do is talk to outsiders, you spend all your time educating and none moving your work forward. The problem arises when you never talk to outsiders.
So if I can take those in reverse order, the issue is the definition of who's an outsider and who's an insider. We're not talking about having to explain to amateurs or non-credentialed physicists what the issue is. We're talking about artificially saying that we are a group of experts and we are not going to talk to other experts with the same training and the same background and the same expertise because we make a commitment to a certain hypothesis and they don't. So that's a very different thing. And remind me of the first one, because...
First one was just talking about the inevitability.
Oh, the inevitability. Thank you. As part of working on this book, I looked at the history of ideas about unification going back to Kepler and Galileo and what happened. Because we've always been in a situation where science pushed the boundaries of what was technologically possible. This is not a new thing. And that quote of Feynman has been said over and over again in the history of science. Science is, for example, in the late 19th century, science is almost over. We're at the limits of technology. And what I found is that there were two cases historically, predominantly. In one case, there was a new theory, and it wasn't testable with old technology, but rather quickly, that is within years, a few years, somebody thought of a way to craft a new technology based on the new theory that became meaningful and workable and allowed tests of the new theory. And that happens over and over again. The second case, and Giovanni Emiliano Camelia and other people finding a way to use astrophysical observations already in progress or already planned as probes of the Planck scale is an example of that. It took insight and cleverness. And by the way, I should mention, there were a few people who had thought about this kind of thing before Giovanni, and they were roundly ignored. But certainly Giovanni was the person who brought it to us so forcefully that it could not be ignored, and so well. The other case is where a theory makes predictions that disagree with observation and experiment, but of course, if it just disagrees, it would never come to light, but has adjustable features where it can be adjusted to hide the disagreement with experiment. And then you get into a game where as technology progresses, you're adjusting to keep yourself out of conflict. And examples like that are, for example, the work on the ether and the sort of vision of the electromagnetic field as stresses in the ether and atoms as vortices in those stresses and so forth, that was the center of theoretical physics in the last decades of the 19th century. And the fate of these research programs is to go on for some time until somebody, in that case Einstein, completely reinvents an interpretation of the evidence in another direction.
Let's hear from another caller. Jason, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Thanks for taking my call, Michael.
Sure.
The author had mentioned earlier about the dearth of experimental data in the last couple of decades. And my question was along those lines, is the lack of data at all related to lack of sufficient equipment? And specifically I'm referring to a couple of false starts that have been along trying to create superconducting super colliders and such, and I'll take my answer offline.
Thank you.
Yes, so first of all, it's not that there's been a dearth of data. There's been a lot of very good work by our experimental physics colleagues in elementary particle experiment, but everything that's come out of that work has confirmed the standard model of particle physics from 1973, except that a small adjustment needed to be made to accommodate the fact that neutrinos have mass. So it's not an issue. Now, it's true that had the superconducting supercollider not been canceled, we would be probing fundamental particle physics at a scale that the Large Hadron Collider is going to in over the next several years. And this is going to be very important, and it's going to test some important hypotheses about elementary particle physics. For example, distinguish supersymmetry from prion models, from technicolor, from other hypotheses that have to do with the properties of the Higgs boson. But, and this is highly important and for the good, but unfortunately, these tests will not be tests of string theory, because string theory is compatible with almost any conceivable outcome of those experiments.
Lee Smolin, it's been a pleasure to have you here. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of the hour, but I want to remind listeners that you'll be at Bookshop West Portal in San Francisco tonight at 7 o'clock, and the title of Lee Smolin's book is The Trouble with Physics, The Rise of String Theory, The Fall of a Science, and What Comes Next. Appreciate again your being with us.
Thank you. A great pleasure.
Forum is with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Our interns are Barton Kreith, Elsa Chang, Leah Wellborn, Michael Fisher, Negar Gobadi, and Mary Trail. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And another hour coming your way. We thank you for your listenership. We'll talk with Michael Lewis about his new book, The Blind Side, in the hour coming up. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.